Oh, before we start, I had the worst week ever. You guys got to hear this. Personal trainer friend of mine just got sentenced to 10 years.
What?
For selling and dealing cocaine.
Oh, my God.
I've seen this guy for years. I had no idea.
Oh,
my gosh.
It just goes to show that you never know people, really. I mean, I had no idea whatsoever that this guy was a personal trainer.
I was adjusting my hearing aid when you said the... It was like the punchline. I totally missed it. And the punchline was...
I had no idea this guy was a personal trainer.
Oh.
Let's see this.
Hey there, heathens. I'm John, the Godless Engineer.
Hi, I'm Aaron Rod.
Hi, this is Andrew Jasko.
This is Don Queen from the Godless Heathens Podcast.
Hello, I'm Dr. Hector Garcia.
Hi, this is Owen from Rex and Owen and the Skeptical Texan.
Hey, I'm Stephen Woodford of Rationality Rose.
Hi, I'm Thomas Westbrook of Holy Kool-Aid.
Hi, this is Matt Delahunty.
Hi, this is Britt and Nikki from Unapologetics.
Hi, I'm Donald Trump, and I took a rip. Wait, which one second? I gotta put my hands up here.
Just go ahead, Robert. Just go.
Hi, I'm Robert Stanley of the Right to Reason podcast, and
I took a left at the valley.
And we. Oh, should I say it too?
No, sure.
I know we shouldn't have to scream that we're atheists. You know, we don't have non-astrologers and all that. But with the religious people taking over the world, I mean, we can either speak up or be pushed into a corner.
I'm proud to be an atheist, a skeptic, a non-believer, an infidel, a heathen. I call it how I see it. I say it's ignorance and you just call it faith in unsubstantiated claims. That's something to be ashamed. I'm an atheist.
I find that no school.
Returning after a well-deserved mini vacation, this is Left of the Valley. My name is Kevin, and I just read a book about Stockholm Syndrome. It was pretty bad at first, but by the end, I kind of liked it. Joining me as usual is a team whose winter fat is gone, but now they have spring rolls. She yes. abducted a mime last night, and she did unspeakable acts to him. Nancy.
Oh, you hit the camera rolling.
Oh, no. Nancy, what are you going to do? You got caught on camera.
And she. And she wonders if Storm and Black Panther had kids, would they be Thundercats? Kirsten. Ooh. Good question, huh?
Yes. I'm going to go with yes.
Ladies, welcome back. You guys enjoyed your week off, I hope?
We had a pretty good week, didn't we?
Yeah, we did.
I have to apologize right away because I'm completely congested and I've got this horrible dry cough. I'm going to try to manage my best and I'm sucking on some Cepacol lozenges now, so bear with me. Anyway, so today we're going to have a great show. We're going to be talking to Professor Joel Bakken of UBC, and we're going to be talking about corporations.
We've been looking forward to that for a long time.
Absolutely have.
Yeah.
But first, let's get to it, a little chit-chat. Did you guys hear that apparently they found 13 fossil bones and teeth in the Philippines that might represent a new unknown human species?
Ooh.
Yeah. There's a cave in Calo on the island of Luzon. They're thinking of calling the species Homo luzonensis. They found three specimens, and these specimens were between 50 and 67,000 years old. Apparently, this would be almost a cousin to the what they call the hobbit.
Oh.
The human species that was short. So it was a short stature human as well.
Hmm.
A shorter version of a human species.
My descendants.
Maybe
no,
so.
I mean, I'm the descendant of...
Yes, yes.
I'm sorry. There we go.
She almost slipped up there.
Yeah. Almost revealed her true age.
Yeah.
Did you guys hear that the U.S. apparently have decided to revoke the visa of a court prosecutor for the International Criminal Court?
Oh, of course, anything that they can do that's absolutely contrary to common sense and good governance, they're going to do. So was there anybody that was surprised?
Yeah, well, I was a bit surprised they would go that far.
Yeah.
I mean, the U.S. was never really been a member of the ICC, but the Trump administration apparently is cracking down on a global tribunal. The prosecutor in question, her name is Fatou Bensouda, who I'll get this right, she had a pending request to look into possible U.S. war crimes in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a move from the U.S. to basically block her from being able to investigate that.
Yeah, but my understanding is that she'll still be able to come in for meetings and so forth. But the U.S. is not part of that tribunal.
No, exactly, yeah. Exactly. Did you guys hear that Norway, apparently, they've sold so many electric cars in March that the electric cars have actually outsold the gasoline cars for the first time in history?
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, it actually represented 60% of all car sales in March.
They must have a better incentive program and charging and so forth for them, you know, people to buy.
They're way ahead of us.
Like, they probably have charging stations everywhere, so it's like, okay, yeah, well, why not get it?
And the price must be comparable as well.
On my birthday, I actually went and spoke with a Tesla dealership, and they're fancy, nice cars. I'm seriously considering one at this
moment.
If I can get out of getting my big pickup there, because I still owe money on that, and if I can somehow merge the two and all that, I will seriously take a good look into it. Because for the travel I do, which is back and forth from work and in town and a bit in Vancouver, it's perfect.
Percentage-wise, how much would a Tesla be? I mean, if you have a regular automobile that's comparable but just not a Tesla, and it was like $20,000, how much more would it?
Well, the one I'm looking at right now would be about $45,000. It's got the bigger battery package. The bigger battery package you got, the longer distance you can get. And this one is, with a bigger battery package, you can do like at least 500 kilometers plus before you have to recharge.
So would they be twice as expensive as a car comparable?
I don't know if you can say twice as expensive. More expensive, yes. But it depends how you... I mean, right now, from my pickup truck, with the price of gasoline right now, it's costing me at least $120 a week.
Yikes.
So you're talking about $500 a month in fuel. That's a car payment.
For those of you who are in the U.S., those of us in Canada, when we go to the pump, we pay for gas by the liter.
That's right.
And there are 4 liters in an imperial.
Yeah, 3.84, something like that, for per imperial gallon or something like that.
Right. So while in the U.S. you might buy gas for $3 a gallon, here it would be like $1.64 a liter, which would bring it up to
at least $5.
$5.
At least $5 per gallon. It's more expensive than the fuel in the States, for sure.
Right.
But let's face it, the price of fuel is not going to drop down back to 80 cents.
It's a little more expensive in the States as well. It's closer
it's getting,
to three
yeah, it's getting
now.
More. Yeah, yeah, it's getting between 3 and 4, I think, is where it's sitting right now.
And the nice thing is, with an electric car, you don't have that extra cost of all that fuel.
Yeah. The other problem is since I live in an apartment building, I got to find a place to plug it in.
Yeah.
That's my other little problem. But I can probably solve that.
I think that's the main block for electric vehicles right now, is the lack of plug-ins. Oh, there's a plug-in at the TD down the road. If you want that one.
Yeah, that's right. I'll just go park the car there.
There you go. Just charge it there.
Do you guys hear that, you know, the island, the Komodo Island with the Komodo dragons? Well, they're closing the island because people have been, quote, stealing the dragon.
What? For what, pets?
Apparently. Apparently, they've stolen... Tourists have stolen over 41 dragons at this point.
People are stupid.
And apparently they're selling them for $35,000 a piece.
How do you steal them? I mean, do you stick them up your shirt?
You'd have to steal
a little kettle?
You'd have to steal a very small one to begin with, because those things are huge. And not just that.
That's what I was wondering. How do you... I mean, you could almost ride one out of the park.
Yeah. And not overly friendly.
And they're extremely dangerous.
Yeah.
That's what people don't realize, you know? I mean, some of the bacteria in their saliva is so toxic, that's how they kill.
Oh, yeah. Don't they just bite them and
they
wait?
They bite and wait for the infection to go, and they just follow until the creature just dies of blood poisoning, and boom, that's it. So I'm not sure that you want that as a pet. So the UNESCO is basically...
No, I was kidding.
Yeah, UNESCO is basically saying there's about approximately 5,000 dragons left on the islands and surrounding islands, so they're closing those islands because apparently people are just too stupid.
Okay. Guys, if you want Toothless, go get yourself a black cat. It's like a little Toothless, and you have a mini house panther too. It's fantastic.
Yeah, just put some wings on it. Scientists, you guys probably saw that, scientists have unveiled for the first image of a black hole at the center of the Messier 87 galaxy. You saw that image?
Right, and who was the head of the team?
Oh, I don't, well, I know it's a woman, but I didn't put that down. Anyway, this galaxy is 55 light years away. It was a scientific collaboration called the Event Horizon Telescope, and it involved 200 scientists from 20 countries.
I can't remember her name, but she's really a powerhouse.
Yeah, there's a 29-year-old woman that is one of the most responsible for the algorithm that helped create the image.
I know. I mean, it just does so much good for women in science and to for the STEM program. Mm-hmm. Everything has just taken a boost because of what she's done.
Now, when you see that image, it kind of looks like a donut thing. You have to understand that for us lay people, I'm no astrophysicist, but I'm going to try to explain. Essentially, what you're seeing the ring of light is actually the light that is being warped around. So imagine having a light behind the black hole, and it's warping around the black hole. It's going far enough from it without being pulled in, and that's what we're seeing, essentially, and escaping it. They are analyzing the data from our own black hole in our galaxy, in the Milky Way, which is called Sagittarius A. But this is the first one they've released, so it's going to be very interesting. And last but certainly not least, I got to ask your maybe your opinion on Julian Assange, that was essentially expelled from the Ecuadorian embassy when he took refuge in there in 2012 to avoid extradition to Sweden over a sexual assault case, which will have been dropped since. And the co-founder of WikiLeaks was arrested this week, and he's charged with hacking. And he faces at least 5 years in jail at this point. Do you guys have any thoughts on this?
Yeah, the embassy is thrilled that the worst hygiene offender in the world and the guy who never picked up his cats is finally got. Portugal is now heaving a sigh of relief. But I think it's about time. He was there for 8 years. He's not a journalist.
You think it's a good thing that they got him? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'm not sure I agree with you on this.
That's okay. I just don't think he's a journalist. I think from everything I know, he participates in stealing information.
Well, that's the funny thing.
So it's not a matter of a free press. It's a matter of whether he's actively engaged in spying and sabotage. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'm not a fan.
That's the funny thing about him, though. I mean, he's accused of hacking, yet there is no mention of the word hacking in any of the documents that he's been accused of. And at the same time, WikiLeaks, love him or hate him, they don't release opinion pieces. Hmm. They just release what they get. They receive stuff and they just release it. That's what they do. So there's no misinformation in what they release, and you got to give them that. So I don't know where I stand right now. A lot of people are saying that it's a bad idea and it's a blow to journalism, and I have a tendency to agree. Assange himself, what kind of person is he as his character? I don't know. I'm not sure where I stand at this point. It's really one of those things. I really don't know which side of the fence I fall on.
Well, it seems that he's... I haven't read in depth either, but it seems as though he will resort to anything to get the information, and that's where the fault
maybe
lies, not in publishing it, because free press is free press, and the free press, if they don't know where something comes from, they can publish it and they're not at fault. But between Chelsea Manning and I gather he encouraged Chelsea Manning to get all of that. That's where the problem.
Yeah, that's where the
problem.
And
then there's some involvement with the Russian government as well. It'll sort itself out.
Will it?
Yeah.
Will it, or is it just a way to silence him and silence people that have a tendency to go after the story?
Yeah, well, I'm
We could almost
optimistic.
Do a show on that. Yeah.
Yeah, if we know of anybody who has more knowledge on this, I'd love to, learn as much as possible and be able to form my opinions maybe, on more facts than I actually have.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's certainly something we'll have to take a look at, because if it is just a way to shut them up, then this sets a really dangerous precedent.
Yeah, but my understanding is that if anybody's out there that knows more, give us an email.
And we've said on the show, the past couple of years have been very dangerous for journalists. Is this a trend that's going to continue?
Yeah.
And is he just simply another victim of that trend? Or is his case really different?
My understanding is that it's different, because I've been listening to quite a bit. And sometimes the pundits aren't always right, and they come with an agenda.
Yeah.
But my understanding is that it is not journalism and free press. It's all of the background
stuff. So. I can understand if they wanted to put him in court for going beyond what a journalist would do to get the information that he wants to release. I can understand that. But if he's done something that's, within, because some journalists will go all to great lengths to get the story, I get that. But if he's done nothing that's too much out of the ordinary.
But I guess part of it is that Chelsea Manning got sentenced and Assange didn't. But essentially they were in cahoots. Mm-hmm. Doing exactly the same thing.
Exactly. Well, it's going to be an interesting story to follow for sure.
Oh, absolutely.
All right. Well, moving on there.
Tell me a story that isn't politically interesting in this time of our life.
May you live in interesting times, right?
Yeah, put a dartboard up and pick one.
May you live in interesting times. All right, my dear Nancy.
Exactly.
You got a top 10 for us?
I do. Actually, I was thinking this week that this usually starts the good weather in North America, and like yourself, there are a lot of people who like to take their Harleys and their old Indians and their other form of motorcycles out on the road, and maybe people are starting to plan where they're going to go. So here are 10 of the best motorcycle rides.
Ooh, nice.
in North America. I mean, they're not numbered 1 through 10 because it's really hard to rate. I think it's personal pleasure and where you want to go. So here's some really interesting places that I don't know.
All you bikers out there.
Yeah, Kevin, would you be tempted to go to the U.S. and take a good motorcycle ride, or would you rather stay up here in Canada if you had the time?
Oh, if I had the time, well, I'd probably go anywhere if I had the time.
Okay, well, there may be some on the list that will appeal to you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, in no particular order, the first one would be the Blue Ridge Parkway in Virginia, which is an absolutely gorgeous road that covers Virginia and the North Carolinas. Very scenic, Blue Ridge Parkway. It runs for 469 miles, starting from Waynesboro, Virginia, and then to the south near the Cherokee Indian Reservation in North Carolina. I've driven part of that, and it really is just beautiful. You just don't want to blink, or you want to go like 3 miles an hour in order to just enjoy what's by the side of the road. It's absolutely gorgeous. So a lot of hidden treasures that are there along the way, and so that ought to be a starting point from anybody on the East Coast that they would like to go. And it goes through the Shenandoah National Park, the Great Smoky Mountains National Park, and the road allows no commercial traffic or business. So,
oh, nice.
That's a good thing. It's about 2 or 3 day ride. So if you want to, plan it, plan for plenty of time. Here's one, top of the world highway in Canada and the U.S. And that goes through Alaska Highway 5 and the Yukon Highway 9. It's only 79 miles long, so it's not a long ride. It takes more time to get up there than it does to do the ride. It's a highway that has a lot of ruggedness, sort of like the last frontier, mostly hard-packed gravel road, some pavement, but it's a challenge. So if you like a challenge.
Sure it is, yeah.
Yeah.
Especially if it's just gravel.
Yeah, that might be someplace. It would take a while. How long would it take to get from British Columbia to the Alaska Highway in the Yukon.
Oh, I would say at least 15 hours, at the very least.
So that would be a ride in itself, I guess, unless you've got it on a flatbed somewhere. So that might be nice just to include British Columbia and go all the way, all the way out. The next one is close to us, the North Cascades Highway. Mm. Have you been down there, Kevin?
Nope.
Have you been to North Cascades? It's really pretty. State Highway 20 from Burlington, Washington, which is about 2 hours, hour and a half from where we are. And that's on the western edge, and it goes to the Okanagan. And at the eastern slope is supposed to have one of the really hidden, it's supposed to be a hidden treasure of the motorcycle road. So come up here, do the North Cascades, be a part of our show, and then go up to Alaska. I mean, this is where I've got your summer, if you want, I've got your summer planned already.
Absolutely.
You bet. The next one is the Beartooth Highway and Chief Joseph Scenic Byway. That's a long sign in itself in the U.S. Those are in Montana and Wyoming. Ooh. Yeah, you look interesting. Would that
be
one? Yeah, it would be. That's interesting. Interesting.
Wait,
country.
So you telling me Wyoming exists for real?
Pardon?
You telling me Wyoming exists for real? I thought it was an invention of the media.
No.
Yeah,
there's actually a place called... Oh, wow.
Yeah. Absolutely. These by themselves could have been two separate inductees in the top 10, but because they're so close, the authors of this list put them close together, and the reason they love it is because there's a series of switchbacks and zigzags, and you get to... a 10,947 mark at the top of Beartooth Pass, which must be a real thrill, and then you go down the Chief Joseph Highway. So that supposed to be really, really beautiful. So I'll say it again, that's the Beartooth Highway and Chief Joseph Scenic Byway. Anybody interesting, look that one up. Here's one that I've driven, and it scared the living daylights out of me. Highway 89 and 89A, Jerome to Wickenburg in Arizona. When you go from Phoenix to Sedona, which is one of the greatest places in the world to go, it's just mystical and scenic. There are two ways to go. You can go the highway, or you can go through part of the desert going to Jerome. And I decided, no, I'm not going the highway. I'm going to Jerome. People who like challenges go. And I was white knuckled the entire way.
When we say white knuckle, I always envision Arizona. I mean, I've only been to Arizona a few times, but it's mostly flat. So what was so white knuckly about
it? As you're going through, you can see the mountain ahead of you, and you get very close, and you think, oh, this ought to be a piece of cake, you know, just going. But it's got switchbacks and hairpin turns, and as you're driving, there's barely enough room for you to go up and another car to come down on that side. So it's like, and there's no place to stop. So you keep going until you get to Jerome. Then you run out, you go to the bathroom, you get something cold to drink, you pant for about 25 minutes, and then you think, okay, I'm ready now. But it's only 12 miles, but there are 100 curves in that 12-mile stretch.
Wow.
So in a motorcycle, it's got to be thrilling. In a station wagon full of gear, it wasn't so thrilling. But maybe if I did it a second time, I'd be more prepared.
Now that you're prepared for it and you know what's going to come.
Yeah, you know what's going to happen. But this is the hill that you go up is part of the Sonoran Desert. So you leave some time because you may want to turn around and go in the opposite direction, but you may really just want to go ahead and go to just some more scenic places, Lake Powell or whatever, on the other side. Anyway, another one that I've been on, which is absolutely spectacular, is called Going to the Sun Road, and that's in western Montana, and it's one of the most scenic rides in the U.S. And it you go through Glacier National Park, which is beautiful. But the Going to the Sun Highway, I think, has been there since the 1920s, and like many other, or maybe earlier, like many other highways, it was all labor, you know, to get through the mountain passes, and so every curve that you go around is a different view, and it's absolutely fantastic. So it's very windy and it's very narrow and it's absolutely gorgeous. And anybody who would like to go, that's a good recommendation. Now here's one from Canada. It's called the I'm going to just mess this up. It's in Alberta, Kananaskis, K-A-N-A-N-A-S-K-I-S, Kananaskis Trail. It's part of Alberta's Highway 40. And south, have you been through there going?
No, I don't think so.
I've only been through Edmonton and just north of it.
So really, really, really far from it.
Yeah.
So this is the highest paved road in Canada. It's called the Highwood Pass, and it's located just west of Calgary.
Mm.
Yeah, so they have snow on the peaks, and it's not a road that you want to go on in the wintertime. No. At this time of year, to plan those in Canada that haven't been there, that's a great place to go. Believe it or not, Death Valley is on
list. Yeah,
and it's probably a big surprise, but taken for what it is, it's just a simple the road going through the desert. You leave Nevada on Pahrump on Highway 178 west, and it was a trading route at one time. Mm-hmm. So that's one. Be careful of the weather.
Yeah, still. Because you know what? Riding a motorcycle when it's hot and you have hot wind blowing at you, it's like riding in front of a hairdryer. It's not fun.
Yeah, but it's a well-maintained road, so at least you're not going to worry. The last two are the Black Hills of South Dakota, and that's near Sturgis, which is the great motorcycle rally, I guess, in the world, you know. So you go through Mount Rushmore, Crazy Horse Monument, all in one day, so it really is great. And if you go to Sturgis, go after or before the rally, not during the rally when it's so crowded. And last but not least, the Mexico Federal Highway 1, and it's called the Trans-Peninsular Highway.
Mm.
It runs down the Baja Peninsula, 1,000 miles.
Wow.
And it starts south of San Diego in Tijuana, and ends up at Cabo San Lucas. And it says that ride will just leave you breathless. Have you ever heard of that ride?
I've heard of it.
Yeah.
I've heard of it.
It's supposed to be a really good pavement. Some of Mexico doesn't always have, you know, the best of pavement. But there you go. You've got the top of Alaska till the peninsula, Cabo San Lucas, and everywhere in between. So
sounds like a road trip.
It is. If you had to choose, which one, if you can remember one out of the 10, which sounded like it would be the most spectacular for you?
Oh boy. The one I'm always told to do from my biker buddies, which, you know, they always trying to coerce me to do Route 66, which I'm surprised was not on there.
It's kind of the classic
the
one,
classic,
isn't it?
Yeah, the classic Route 66. Yeah,
I think perhaps because There are places where there is no 66, and a lot of it is more commercial, so you don't get a lot of the outdoor scenery. You get to go through a lot of great towns, but not necessarily you know, places that are scenic. But to say that you did it and go from coast to coast, that
would be something else.
Yeah, so what appealed to you, Kirsten?
Oh, I think I know I loved it when we drove up for a road trip up to Kelowna, so I think going up to the Yukon and Alaska, doing that.
Oh, yeah.
I think that would be really nice.
It'd be interesting. I'm surprised, too, that there's not the route that in Ontario, I guess it'd be Highway 1, that just goes around the Great Lakes, around Lake Superior. The scenery, you just
That would be gorgeous.
Yeah, you just got the immense lake on one side there, which looks like the ocean, essentially, at that point. And you're just riding it. It's nothing but forest as well. Yeah. So that'd be a great route as well.
It would, but you know, the thing about the top 10 list is that it's somebody's list that decided
Yeah, that,
exactly. They were the top 10 for them.
You take it
somebody
with a grain
else's
of salt.
List, you know, that route around the lakes might be number one on someone else's
yeah, exactly.
List.
Perfect. Yep. Well, thank you, my dear Nancy. Mm-hmm. My dear Kristen, do you have another brilliant moment for us?
Yes, I do.
Brought to you by religion.
Well, so we know that pot is legal now here in Canada.
Boy, do we know.
But it's still illegal in Wisconsin. However, a church known as the Lion of Judah House Rastafari is arguing that the law allows for it to use marijuana as part of its religious practices, despite a statewide ban.
It was Rastafarian, yeah.
To be blunt, the church known as the Lion of Judah House
to be blunt.
Okay. Rastafari was made possible through the joint effort of Jesse Schwark and Dylan Bangert.
Was a joint effort?
Joint effort.
Both said the First Amendment and the Religious Freedom Restoration Act protects them and allows them to use marijuana as part of their religious practice. The First Amendment states that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion prohibiting the free exercise thereof.
Yes.
Schwark said he knows his rights and said using cannabis is how people in the Rastafarian religion weed out the bad. This is a non-profit church, Schwark said. We all use cannabis to meditate and also for the religious purpose for uplifting our mind and our body and our spirit. Wisconsin is behind the times when it comes to medical cannabis legalization or decriminalization. So if religion is the loophole they're using, well, it's among the least problematic things religion has ever been used
to
justify.
Yeah, I would agree. Of all the loopholes they find, that's the least one.
The operators of the sanctuary seem open-minded, but they still don't want people to think they can just walk in and buy weed from their church. That would certainly get them shut down. Cannabis is used as a religious sacrament. You can't just roll up and buy it. You have to be a member of their church and make donations to them. And Schwark made it clear that they do not sell it and it cannot be gifted to the public.
There we go.
We just want people to be sincere in that aspect of the religion, Schwark said. We don't have to agree on everything. We are open. We are all denominational. So you come as you are. Be yourself, share your stories, and the things you know. We don't have a monopoly on knowledge or anything like that. We just try to encourage people to talk and have fellowship together and break bread.
There we go.
So it's just like, you know, be happy, get high.
Almost sounds like the kind of church we would join.
Yeah, I'd rather join a church that has to do with robbing banks. So, you know, as part of your religion, you know, to keep accumulating wealth. And, I mean, I think you could hide behind religion for whatever. You want to get high or do you want to go rob banks and have money?
You know, maybe you could have been a good thuggy, you know. I mean, you have to kill people if you're part of the religion. You know?
I could start that one.
Yeah, well, it used to be there.
Yeah.
You could just revive it.
Yeah, the Assassin Church of Holy Ascension or something.
There we go.
I like it.
Yeah.
It's got a nice ring to it, Nancy.
It does.
You could just say you're a holy warrior and you gotta go forth and defeat evil. And that includes, you know, killing a person once in a while.
That's right.
And making a profit out of it, too.
You gotta get rid of the bad people.
That's right. That's right.
That's right. We could include a little pot in that as well, you know, for meditation purposes only.
When it comes to religion, you could put anything.
You're centering the mind.
You can't beat the batshit crazy that's out there already.
No.
I guess I got to get another T-shirt, the Assassin Church of the Holy Ascension. Yeah.
Patreon goal.
I know.
The Assassin Church. Member of the Church of Assassination.
Yeah, there you go.
All right. Get something
not
else?
Not assignation. It has to be assassination.
Assassination.
But it could be either.
Okay, so in a story so weird, you'd swear it had to take place in Florida. A Kentucky man is suing a hotel because his manager allegedly tried to force him into an exorcism.
Hold on. The manager tried to force a guy into an exorcism?
Yes.
How do you do that? How do you... Excuse me, sir. You need to be exercised today for some reason or another. We're not sure why, but...
I've already been doing my exercises this morning. So
no. Exorcise. Oh. It's good that you do your exercise before your exorcism.
Oh,
it's good.
That's where the problem starts.
You want to make sure you get in better shape than you demons.
Gotcha.
Demons are lazy to begin with.
Anyways, Jason Fields began working at a Hampton Inn in Hazard, Kentucky.
Oh, it's in Kentucky.
Oh, that's
no
the
wonder.
Problem, right?
Around June of 2016, as a front desk employee. When his boss, Sharon Linden, found out he was getting divorced, she told him she was a member of a local church and blamed his marital problems on demons.
Oh, of course.
And no front desk employee of hers could have demons. Linden is accused of telling Fields he had to get cleansed in order to keep working at the hotel. Linden gave Fields a questionnaire with many questions about religion and intimate activities. Fields said in the lawsuit he was asked to return it to Linden before undergoing an exorcism.
Now, the funny thing is, if you met his ex-wife, she's the demon. That's why he's getting rid of her.
Oh. Fields accuses Linden of punishing him for not participating in the questionnaire and exorcism by changing his shift and bringing in people from her ministry to pray for him while he was working. This would happen in front of the guests, and this would lead Fields to quit his job.
Way over the line. Way over the line, lady.
Mm-hmm. And when you look at the questionnaire issued by Linden, you can see why he had no desire to fill it out. And wouldn't it just happen? I have the questions.
Oh, boy. Okay. Question time. Let's see what we would answer
here
these questions.
Go.
Okay. What is your church background?
Well, that's innocuous.
Briefly explain your conversion experience.
Uh-oh. I went on to Damascus, fell off a horse, banged my head.
Were you baptized as a child?
No, the priest tried to drown me first.
In one word, who is Jesus Christ to you?
The fraud that people perpetuate till this day.
What does the blood of Calvary mean to you?
It means somebody needs to clean up in aisle five.
Is repentance part of your Christian life?
Who?
What is your prayer life like?
Non-existent at this point.
And they get weirder from here.
Really?
You passed those. Now
God.
To go on to the second.
Not sure I can answer. I can't find too many answers to these questions.
Were you a planned child? Were you conceived out of wedlock? Have you personally ever had psychiatric counseling? Have you, your parents, or grandparents been in any cults?
No, yeah, they're all Christians.
Have you ever made a pact with the devil?
No, but I'm starting to wish I did.
Have you ever been involved in Eastern religion?
Eastern religion? Oh, like Buddhism or something like that.
Have you ever visited heathen temples? Do you have any witches, such as Good Luck Kitchen Witches, in your home?
Good Luck Kitchen Witches?
Good Luck Kitchen Witches.
What the hell? What's a Good Luck Kitchen Witch?
I don't know.
I've got a sandwich.
I don't know, but if the kitchen witch cooks, they come to my house.
We're down.
I've got a sandwich in my fridge. Does that count?
Okay. And here we go. Do you have lustful thoughts?
Right now,
all
I do.
All the time.
I'm having lustful thoughts just about this right now.
That's right.
To your knowledge, was there evidence of lust in your family line? Do you frequently masturbate?
I'm doing it right now.
Have you ever been a victim of incest by a family member?
Oh, God.
Have you ever committed incest, rape, or molested anyone?
No, I'm not a Catholic priest.
10 points for Nancy with that one.
Have you ever committed fornication, adultery, been with prostitutes, had homosexual or lesbian desires or experiences?
In other words, have you ever had any fun?
Yeah. Pretty much. Have you ever sexually fantasized about an animal?
Ew. No.
Have you been involved in oral or anal sex? Have you...
What time is it?
Have you fathered a child that has been aborted? Has pornography ever attracted you? And last, do you have desires of having sex with a child?
Holy crap.
That is the questionnaire.
That's pretty an intense questionnaire and really deep into the personal life of a person.
Can you think?
Can you just imagine the questions they left out?
Yeah. That's way over the line.
Those are the ones that made it. Holy goodness. Yeah. I'd like to see the ones that are in the wastebasket.
But it just shows their mindset that right away they think that, you know, they start blaming all the ailments of the world on you, and they they're highly directed towards sex right away.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, oh, you're not guilty of this? Well, try this one on.
Have you been raped as a child? No, but did you rape people? It's like, you don't ask.
So the company that oversees the hotel chain has stated that they oppose faith-based discrimination and are investigating the incident.
She needs to get fired. Big time. This is way over the line.
I would love to see it when they read the questionnaire.
Oh, my God. Huh. I'm amazed you got those questions, by the way.
I mean, even in Hazard, Kentucky, that's a little...
Yeah, even for Kentucky.
Like, that's...
So the employer, was it the Creation Museum? With Ken Ham? Was it the employer?
Well, believe it or not, well, that's a silly way to start. But I knew people who were actively doing... exorcism as part of marital counseling. They were part of a group they were casting out demons. And it was, how do you talk to people? I mean, you know, and I'm pretty diplomatic in talking. To actually have conversations about doing it is really difficult. But it does exist.
Yeah, you know, it kind of cuts your mood for the honeymoon, doesn't it? Oh. When you tell you have to go through an exorcism first.
Yeah. Christina and I are friends with our demons, so it's all good.
Yes, that's right. Snuggling
with demons. We snuggle with our demons.
Snuggling with the demons.
Oh my God! The Christianity today, the stuff. Anyway, we could go on with this. Thank you, my dear.
Thank you, Kirsten.
Like, here, in order to keep working here, fill out this questionnaire, and when you're finished, wait 3 hours past your appointed time, and we'll get to your exorcism.
That's right.
And at the end, he said, well, you better do this quick, because the next full moon I'll turn into a werewolf. It's like, these people are insane. Well, thank you, my dear. Perfect. So let's take a quick pause, and when we come back, we'll be with Professor Joel Backen, and we'll be talking about corporations. So stay with us.
Listen to the Sacrilege Cast podcast, YouTube video, interview program that features me talking to some of the best and brightest in the atheist/secular/awesome community. I interview people. We curse and usually drink beer because why not? It's the Sacrilege Cast, ZACHRILEGE, and I can spell it after two beers so you can too.
If your skepticism is socially conscious and doesn't take itself too seriously, you might like life, the universe, and everything else.
People like Ray Comfort are fond of saying, what use is half a wing, right? Have you ever seen a fucking penguin?
Life, the universe, and everything else. Available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and pretty much anywhere else.
I don't know, Zoom? Is that still a thing?
Years, this old man had taught us, and he believed that the Golgi apparatus was an artifact. He thought it didn't exist. And then one day, an American cell biologist came and gave a public lecture in our department, in which he demonstrated beyond all possible doubt that the Golgi apparatus was real. Our old man strode to the front of the lecture hall, shook him by the hand, and said, "My dear fellow, I wish to thank you. I have been wrong these 15 years. And all of us applauded till our hands were red, and none of us will ever have forgotten that incident. That is science at its best. That's the very opposite of faith.
Sing we now, sing for the year, sing for the laugh and sing for the tear.
Next guest is a professor of constitutional law at UBC. He wrote the book The Corporation, which was later made into a movie, a documentary. It was a fantastic documentary. He's a snappy dresser and a snazzy dancer. Professor Joel Backen, thank you so much for joining us at Left of the Valley.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, you say that now, but you might regret that later. Professor Backen, you and I had some previous encounter, but for our public that might not exactly know who you are, would you be so kind to give us maybe a quick bio as to who Joel Backen is?
Yep, sure. I'm a law professor, but I also like to write books and
make documentary films that reach beyond the university, and try to make them in a way that they're enjoyable to read and informative and enjoyable to watch. To take the ideas that I cook up out at the university and try to send them out into the world, rather than just talking to other eggheads like myself out there at UBC.
Well, I appreciate you giving time to us, the little people.
Well, hardly that, but it's more the egghead people out at the other end.
All right. So I want to talk to you about a book that you wrote that was made into a documentary in 2003, a Canadian documentary called The Corporation. This was essentially, if I'm correct, correct me if I'm wrong, you basically went and said corporations are regarded as a legal person under the law. If they are a legal person, let's psychoanalyze what type of person they are. Would I be correct in basically...
You get an A+ on the exam.
Perfect.
Oh, good. Yay. Stop while you're ahead.
So, yes, stop while I'm ahead. Yeah, you're right. So maybe
that's right, Kevin. But you know what? The sad thing is that you put a book like that out in the world, and you put a film like that out in the world, and you think, okay, well, this is going to wake people up, and it's going to change everything. That's your sort of naive thinking going into it. And so what happened is we put it out there, and there got a lot of, buzz, and it had a lot of impact and all of that. And things just have gotten worse over the last 2 decades. We've got Donald Trump in the White House. We've got corporations more powerful than ever, taking over everything, schools, water systems, being deregulated all over the place. We have the left in disarray to some extent, which is something we can talk about. And so about 3-4 years ago, looking at this situation, I thought it was necessary to take another kick at the can. So I've spent the last couple of years making another film, which I'm now in the process of editing. It'll be out in January 2020, and writing another book, which will be out around the same time.
Fantastic, fantastic. And we'll have to bring you on for sure to promote that as much as we can. But let's go back to the one you did in The Corporation here. It got 90% on Rotten Tomatoes, by the way. The documentary begins with an unusual detail that came from the 14th Amendment, that under constitutional law, corporations are seen as individuals. So can you give us a brief history? Because when people say, "What do you mean corporations are individual?" What does that really mean?
Sure. Well, it depends on how brief you want it to be. The idea actually goes back to Roman law. So, it could spend the next, several hours talking about how it got from Roman law into British law, into Canadian and U.S. law. I guess the first thing to note is that the 14th Amendment, of course, is an amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Mm-hmm. So the idea of personhood is not just a U.S. idea, however. It's an idea that really pervades all legal systems in the world. And the basic idea is this, that you take a bunch of shareholders and, maybe 10 shareholders, maybe 100, maybe 1 million, maybe 10 million for big companies. And those shareholders put their money into the company, and they want to get the benefit of putting their money in the company, but they don't want to suffer the detriment if things go sideways. Mm-hmm. The company pollutes a river and gets sued, or if it goes bankrupt or whatever. So what they do, what the law does, is it says, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to, instead of making those people responsible, we're going to create this fictitious person that is the whole collection of those people. We're going to turn into one person, and that's going to be the corporate person. And that's going to be the person that is on the hook for liabilities. That's going to be the person that operates legally in the economy, and all the shareholders don't have to worry ever about getting sued. And so that's called limited liability. Their liability is limited because we've created this corporate person to assume it.
And these people that created this corporate person, they did that piggybacking essentially on the 14th Amendment, which was essentially, if I remember correctly, giving human rights to the slaves in the U.S., right?
Yeah, I mean, in the U.S., that's how it went. So it's important to draw a couple of distinctions because, of course, U.S. law doesn't govern in Canada or in Britain or anywhere else. So in the U.S., they had their own particular history. And basically, the 14th Amendment was designed to give rights to freed slaves to ensure that they had equality. And some really clever corporate lawyers in the late 19th century said, hey, you know, we can jump on that bandwagon, too, and we can say that we deserve rights. So what we're going to do is we're going to promote an interpretation before the courts that says that corporations are persons, too, just like freed slaves. And so they should also be able to take advantage of the rights that are granted there. So they should also get equality, and they should get freedom of speech, and they should get liberty. So that's how it happened in the United States. In Canada, the way it happened, you know, our charter wasn't brought into the Constitution until 1982. And what happened as soon as it was brought in, and again, some clever lawyers came along for tobacco companies this time and said, you know, we don't like restrictions on tobacco advertising, so we're going to say that as corporate persons, we can avail ourselves of the charter's guarantee of free speech. And they succeeded in that, and they managed to get the law struck down. So in every country, it happens a little bit differently, but the essentials of it are this, that first, the law determines that this collective of shareholders is just one person, the corporate person, and second, the law grants rights to that person, often rights under the Constitution that allow that person to challenge government's attempts to regulate it.
Has there been any country where this attempt at bringing people together as a corporate entity, as a person, was unsuccessful? Are there countries that basically, no, this is not float. This is not going to float?
No. I mean, really, any country that wants to operate in the global economy needs to have a legal, in our capitalist, corporate capitalist global economy, needs to have the capacity to recognize corporations as single persons. It's really the kind of hidden secret of the entire system, is the entire system depends upon that. And so, you know, there are outliers. I mean, there's North Korea, for example. But basically, the world economic system, which is becoming more and more globalized, depends on this notion that when you're talking about General Motors, or you're talking about Nike, or you're talking about any other corporation, that at law is recognized as an individual, as a person.
Wow. Pretty intense.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty intense.
So I guess the idea, it didn't sprout in the U.S. first, or did it?
Well, as I said, the idea that you could have a group of investors treated as one person goes back to Roman times.
Okay, yeah.
And actually, even before that, to Phoenician times. So there's always been this notion that you can kind of magically deem something that's not a person to be a person. And I don't want to get too far down the rabbit hole, but the reason for that is that the law, and this is true of legal systems around the world, the law only recognizes people as being able to have rights and liabilities. And so in order to get something to have rights and liabilities, you need to effectively magically say it's a person. And so there's some interesting things going on in some countries where they say, well, if we do that for corporations, let's do it for trees and let's do it for rivers.
Yes, yes.
And so in New Zealand, they've actually designated certain rivers to have legal personhood so that they'll be protected by the law.
Yeah, wow. They've also done that. I think I read an article in India where they have what they call non-human persons, like dolphins, for example. They have the right; they have legal rights under the law as well.
Yeah,
it's really interesting. So
it's an interesting concept. Then, and it's not in and of itself; it's not a bad concept. But it's become a bad concept because it's enabled very, very, very large concentrations of wealth and power to operate on the same plane as individuals at law. And so that they've been able to leverage this idea to exert their power without the people who benefit from it being liable for the things that they do.
In other words, if I'm facing a corporation, they got way deeper pockets than I do.
You got it.
Exactly.
But it's just you against the corporation. You know, I mean, put the corporation and you in a boxing ring. It's kind of obvious. I mean, I'm not insulting you or anything. I'm sure you'd be good, but. You
know. I appreciate that.
So what, I know this is going to reduce everything to absolute simplicity, but what would you say the major benefit would be because of the law to the corporation, and what would be the major downfall or negative aspect to it?
Right. Well, I think the benefit is that in order to have an economy that functions with businesses that are larger than one or two or three people, you need some way for that entity to operate. You need some way for Ford Motor Company to hire people and enter contracts with them. Well, for the Ford Motor Company to enter a contract, it has to be a person. So in order for a business to operate in the economy, it has to have personhood for it to operate as a business. And so I guess that would be the benefit. I think the downside is that the idea of personhood, A, allows all of the investors in a company to escape responsibility for the things that go wrong, the harms that the company does, while at the same time getting the benefits. So it's like a big irresponsibility machine. A person can invest in a company and they know that they're only going to get the upside. The worst that's going to happen is they'll lose some money in their investment. But if the company does something like BP did to the Gulf of Mexico, nearly destroyed it with the Deepwater Horizon disaster, mm-hmm. none of the shareholders have to worry. You know, their share price goes down a little bit, but nobody's going to come after them and say, you were negligent. That is all laid on the company. And so it enables the whole system to kind of operate in a way that incentivizes, promotes irresponsibility. And that's not a good thing when you have actors that have as much power as major corporations do.
So if you wanted to put a cap on this system that promotes irresponsibility, is there a way for the legal entities, the country, to revoke corporate personhood to a company that's been really irresponsible?
It can happen, and it does happen. But I mean, the answer is in Canadian law and in U.S. law, the incorporation is basically a license that's granted by the state, and it can be revoked. The real politic of it is that does happen with usually small companies that have evaded taxes for years or that have engaged in some other kind of infraction. And they'll have their license, their incorporation will be revoked. But it never happens with even the worst big companies. Enron didn't lose its incorporation. So that doesn't happen. I mean, I think the best way to deal with this problem, I mean, there are a number of ways. One is corporate law used to have restrictions on how big corporations could become. Mm-hmm. They used to have caps on capitalization. We're now hearing some people, like Elizabeth Warren in the United States, talking about breaking up companies like Amazon and Microsoft and Google and Facebook, mm-hmm. Trying to end those monopolies. And in a way, she's going back to a much older approach, which was to say, it's really not a good thing for democracy and for people to have these huge concentrations of wealth and power. So we're going to put limits on how big they can get. We're going to put limits on how much they can acquire other companies, how much they can take over other companies, how much they can merge with other companies. So we can have corporations, fine, but we're going to keep them to a manageable size. Mm. And so I think that's what we're starting to see some discussion about, especially, as I say, from Elizabeth Warren in terms of the big tech companies.
With that, let's say, for example, that Warren is successful and she does that incentive in the States. Would that now maybe like a competing country like China would have the incentive to keep their corporations as is because they're bigger and more powerful at that point and might be able to gobble up the smaller ones?
Yeah, of course, that's the whole problem, is that because we're operating on a global plane these days, we need to worry about things like that. And so, you know, in an ideal world, we would solve these kind of problems globally. Mm-hmm. We would say that it's not good for the planet. It's not good for people. It's not good for health, for welfare, as a planetary system, to have these large, unaccountable concentrations of wealth and power. And so ideally, and again, this is highly ideally, we would go through agencies like the United Nations. We would create treaties that limited the size and scope of corporations. You know, we would take on this issue as a global issue, because it really is that. Because that is always the argument that's made. If we do this here in British Columbia, then, you know, our companies won't be able to compete in Canada. If we do it here in the United States, our companies won't be able to compete globally, and on and on and on. So we end up in this constant paralysis to do anything out of that fear. Now, having said that, I think there are ways to protect local economies. But they're not very much in vogue these days. I mean, they're, you know, we see Trump and his protectionist policies and we condemn him for them and all of that. But there is a progressive history of protectionism that really draws upon the root of the word, which is protect. Mm-hmm. And that is the idea that nation states should be able to say, as a matter of their democratic will, we don't want to allow certain things to happen within our borders and in relation to our citizens and companies. We don't want the environment destroyed. We don't want people's lives destroyed. And so we're going to create policies. And if other countries don't create those policies, then we're not going to trade with them. You know, so it can be done that way, but I think it's much better to be done in a more unified way. And the way, for example, that climate is being approached in the international agreements that are being made around it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I can understand, because it's very complex, because you're obviously dealing with human rights at this point.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. You had a question, Kirsten?
Yeah. So I know we're talking about the corporations and everything and that. So I can see, as with the human rights, how corporations can be seen as psychopaths.
Mm-hmm.
So one question is, what might a corporation look like if it had empathy?
Mm. Yeah, that's a great question. And it's one I'm dealing with now in the new book that I'm dealing with, that I'm writing, and the new film. And the story goes something like this. After we released the corporation, not too long after that, corporations started to say, okay, you know, we got the message. We're changing now. And it wasn't just our film, of course. It was a whole anti-globalization movement and a lot of criticism of corporations in the early 2000s. So you start to see around 2005, big companies becoming sustainable, corporate social responsibility, saying that they're going to really entrench these values at the core of their business models, making all kinds of commitments around human rights, the environment, everything else, and basically saying, we're empathetic now. We're no longer psychopaths. So part of my project in this new film and book is to say, actually, you still are, but you've just become more charming psychopaths. And so I kind of strip away the veneer, and I say, you know, you say you're empathetic, but you're not. So that's part of the story. But then the other part of your question is, okay, is it possible for a corporation to become genuinely empathetic? And there is a whole movement called the B Corporation movement, or the Benefit Corporation movement, that says that's what it's trying to do. It's trying to refashion the laws. It's trying to create various kinds of monitoring and certification schemes that are aimed at making corporations more caring institutions. And I have a lot of problems with that movement. I don't think it delivers on its promise, but that's another story. Yeah. The larger concern I have is that even if we make corporations empathetic, it's still going to be up to those who run them to decide how to exercise that empathy.
Yeah.
And it's still going to be the case that they're not democratic, that they're not accountable, that they have no lines of restraint in any kind of democratically accountable way. So so the idea of leaving corporations with all the power they have, making them empathetic institutions, doesn't quite solve it for me, because then we have an empathetic dictatorship rather than a nasty dictatorship, which is better, but a benevolent dictatorship is still a dictatorship. And so I always argue, instead of trying to change the corporation, what we should do is think about what purposes it serves, what public purposes it serves. And I mentioned a few before. It's a useful vehicle for running a business, for innovating, for delivering services and goods. And let's ask, how can we recraft it? How can we limit its power? How can we limit its size so that the good that it does, but it's not given the power to wreak the kind of havoc and harm that it does? And then what we really need to do is make our governments empathetic, because our governments, unlike corporations, have the fundamental purpose, two fundamental purposes. One is to serve and protect the public good. And two is to do it in a way that reflects the popular will, that's democratic. And the problem with corporations is that they don't have either of those things. So I'm in favor of a larger role for a more democratized, more empathetic government, a smaller role for corporations. And to me, that's kind of the sweet spot. That's where we should be heading, mm-hmm. instead of accepting the power of corporations and saying, let's just make them exercise that power in ways that are nicer.
So right now, like the U.S., for example, they're heading in the completely wrong direction, with, especially with their, what was that ruling?
Citizens United.
Exactly. Saying basically money is speech. And of right. course, corporations have way more power yeah. than us.
Right. Those are wrong-headed decisions. But, you know, even in the absence of Citizens United, the power of corporations is still far, far too great. I mean, there's a great quote from an American Supreme Court Justice, Brandeis, back in the 1930s. And he said, you know, you can have large corporations and the concentrations of wealth and power that they have, or you can have democracy, but you can't have both.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Wow, some scary thought. Mm-hmm. So if, for example, in your movie and in your book, you talk about another model instead of using a typical corporation, because what a lot of people don't think, we live in a democracy, but when you get into your workplace, it's no longer a democracy. It is a dictatorship. You got to do your job or you're fired, right?
Yeah.
Except if you go into a place and you work at a co-op.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering, how come this model of business is not more known or more popular? What is it about co-ops that people don't seem to like?
You can't make as much money. Mm. I mean, you know, if we live in a society where money has become the measure of success, where money has become the measure of goodness, where money is needed to be healthy, to some extent to be happy. But we've taken it way too far. I mean, we live in a world where it seems the values of love, the values of caring, the values of community have all been overshadowed by money. Mm-hmm. And the thing about a cooperative is that it's not designed to make money. It's designed to serve the needs of its members, and that's it. The thing about capitalism, there's a reason why it's called capitalism. There's a reason why capital is the ism. Capital is money that's produced through basically what Marx would call surplus value. that's produced through profit and through growth. And so our entire system is oriented to creating capital, to creating wealth for shareholders. And that is not what cooperatives do. And so in a system that's dominated by that ethos and that practice and that institutional reality, you can have cooperatives like Mountain Equipment Co-op or a cooperative of fishers, halibut fishers up in Prince Rupert. You know, you can have various sectors organizing themselves into cooperatives, but the system as a whole is run on the notion of creating capital. And that is not what cooperatives do. So if we change that system and move to an ism like socialism, where protecting and promoting the social is the ism rather than protecting and promoting capital, then we would have a whole different picture of things. There are places, having said that, where there's a lot of work going on among workers and citizens to try to create a larger presence for cooperatives. Jackson, Mississippi, of all places, has a movement called Cooperation Jackson. That's just incredibly inspiring. And I urge your listeners to Google that, to look that up. Incredibly inspiring example of people who are really sort of answering the question that you asked in a very tangible way and saying, you know, let's try to do this. Let's try to revitalize these impoverished and stressed communities by moving towards this cooperative model. And that's something I'm watching quite closely, and I find very inspiring.
Indeed, that would be inspiring. Cooperation Jackson.
Yeah.
Okay. This might be like a really broad question, but in your opinion, have we reached a limit of what capitalism can do for our society? Is it time for us to start thinking about using another ism, as you say?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think people too often don't really think about what capitalism means. I mean, we say, oh, we like it. You know, we get nice things and some of us are doing okay, though fewer and fewer of us are doing okay. I mean, a lot of people are dropping out. But when you actually think about it, and, you know, if you came down from Mars and you said, okay, so you've got this society and the ism that it's chosen is this idea of capital. So here's a society of people, of folks, of human beings who, you know, who live lives of love and caring and friendship and family and all of these social values, who want to be taken care of and want to take care of others. These sort of better sides of ourselves, our altruism, our communitarianism, all of that. So here's a system where they've said, now forget about all of that. What we're going to do is say that the system should be oriented towards creating capital. That's what we've got. And if you stop and think about it for just half a second, you realize, wow, that's weird. That we've actually taken this idea of capital and we've said that's going to be our ism.
Yeah.
That's going to be our big goal. That's going to be the thing that drives everything.
Especially since, after all, money is essentially an abstract concept.
Well, it is.
It doesn't really exist either, right?
No, it doesn't. And what does exist are people's real needs, their real wants, their real desires, and their real beauty. I mean, that's what exists, is our humanity. So I don't know what the ism is, whether it's socialism or humanism or ecoism or some combination of all of that. But if you just kind of started from the very beginning, if you put all of us behind a veil of ignorance, we didn't know anything, and you gave us, you know, like on the old Let's Make a Deal show, door number one, door number two, yep, door number three, and the different doors were like, okay, what do you want your ism to be? Do you want it to be capital? Do you want it to be social? Do you want it to be love? Do you want it to be eco? I can't imagine that most people would choose capital.
You're absolutely right. However, is it fair to say that we are so entrenched in the system. I mean, people can, if I ask people to describe what the end of the world would look like, they can describe that. But if I describe to me the end of capitalism, they can't. They can't even see the end of the system, but they can imagine the end of the world.
Yeah, it's the air we breathe, it's the water we swim in. It in its current existence is maybe 100 years old. It's hardly definitive of all of human history, though people talk about capitalism as the end of history. It's a ridiculous notion that, you know, that capitalism won't suffer the same fates as every other system that's governed the planet, whether it be, you know, the system of empires, or it be the system of theocracies, or it be any other kind of system. It's a absolutely absurd notion that this is the one system that's going to end history. So yeah, it's. I mean, you know, you hang on to the idea on the one hand that it doesn't make any sense to think that we're going to have capitalism in 1,000 years, if we have anything in 1,000 years. We may not be here. But at the same time, it's very hard to see how it will come to an end. And I guess, you know, I guess I have two things to say about that. And this can be my final note, because I've taken up your half hour. But I think the final note would be that it is definitely going to come to an end at some point. The question is, what lies on the other side of it is better or worse, because there are many kinds of non-capitalist systems that are a lot worse than even capitalism at its worst.
Mm-hmm.
North Korea is not a capitalist country, but it's not a system that I would want to see embraced.
Mm-hmm.
So the question becomes then, how do we imagine, and we have to start imagining and doing the work of imagining, what lies on the other side? What mm-hmm. kind of system we can create that is about trying to bring out, sustain, protect human good, human need, human flourishing, humanism. And then we have to struggle for that. And that is why, I mean, part of the reason I do the work I do is to challenge that idea, or to help people be able to see beyond capitalism, to help people be able to see its contingency, the fact that it's really no more solid or entrenched than any of the other empires or systems that history has thrown up and that fall to ashes. So it's really, I mean, that's why I do the work I do. It's to help people step outside of it a little bit and be able to look at it from not within its own terms, and hopefully spark their imaginations and inspire their action.
Professor, when you see your young students in your class there, do you have hope? Do you see them responding to these ideas?
I do have hope. I see a lot of incredible imagination and commitment among young people today.
Mm-hmm.
And it's why I do the work I do. If I didn't do the work I do, I mean, if I didn't have hope, I wouldn't do the work I do. I would go and make a lot more money being a lawyer. So I do have hope. As I say, there'd be no point in being critical of the society we have in the absence of hope that we can have a better one.
Fantastic. Professor Bakken, thank you so much for helping us with this today. But before I let you go, what's coming down the pipe for Joel Bakken there? Well, you said you're releasing this new movie and this new book by January 2020, right?
Probably, probably somewhere between January and March 2020.
Fantastic.
The book and film will come out. Yep. So, you know, keep your eyes open. It's going to, hopefully it'll hit big and really help people grapple with the very, very confusing times that we're in.
Can I possibly ask what the title will be, or is it still a secret?
Not sure yet.
Okay.
I honestly am not sure yet. Right now, you know, the working title is The Corporation 2,
mm-hmm.
The unfortunately necessary sequel.
So speaking of hope, and your book coming out in 2020, are you beginning to think of the third book after the Trump administration hopefully is driven into the ground?
I am.
I figured.
I am.
That'd be great.
I've got a few ideas queued up that I'm starting to work on.
Professor Bakken, if people want to ask you questions more about, find out more about your books and your film, where can they reach you?
You can go through my website, just joelbakken.com.
JoelBakken.com. Professor, thank you so much for joining us today. Before I let you go, I got to have you say, hi, this is Professor Joel Bakken, and I took a left at the valley.
Hi, this is Professor Joel Bakken, and I took a left at the valley.
Fantastic. And that was Professor Joel Bakken of UBC. That was very, very informative and interesting.
I want to sit in one of his classes.
I know.
I do. So do I. I want to sit
Road
in his
trip.
Class.
Absolutely.
And this is one of those things that most people don't know. There's very few of us that know what really goes on behind the scenes of law and corporate law. Mm-hmm. And I think this is it opens the eyes of a lot of people saying, wait a minute, the corporation is an actual person under the law? Well, no wonder.
Yeah.
So when they go in court against you, well, you got a corporation with billions of dollars and lawyers, and you got you. That's got to work, you know. Yeah.
Yeah. Kevin, where's his film, his documentary available?
His documentary, it came out in 2004, so you're not going to find it on Netflix. But if you look up on YouTube or iTunes, you will find the documentary, which of course was with director Mark Akbar, which is a fantastic man too. It was a great, great documentary, and I highly, highly, highly recommend you watch this. It actually touched me personally, but you know, that's another story altogether.
And the book is available widely on his website.
His website and
Amazon and places,
all good
like
bookstores. You'll find that. So that's not going to be a problem. So should be fun. All right. Well, thank you so much, guys, for being with us today, and thank you, ladies.
Great interview. Just
thank you
great.
To Professor Joel Bakken, and thank you for listening. And you can follow us at leftoutvalley.com. You can follow us on Facebook, on Twitter, at LETV Podcast. You can be a patron. You can go to patreon.com/LETV, and you can be like Freethinker215. Where is the rest of it? Freethinker215 and H. Simpson Support Freedom from Religion Foundation, and help us make the show better. Shout out to this guy, one of our patrons. Where was I with this? Yes, you can send us an email at leftoutvalley.com. Send your complaint. Yes, send your complaints to Nancy on the third floor. Give us a 5-star review whenever you find us. It helps us and helps others find the show. Coming up, okay. Next week we'll have Dr. Matthew Hussinger, and we'll be talking about conspiracies.
Ooh.
And on the 27th we'll have our friend Dr. Hector Garcia talk about his new book. In May we'll have Dr. Del Rey.
A lot of doctors coming up.
A lot of doctors, yes, I know.
Yeah.
We'll be talking about how to renegotiate your relationship. We'll have transgender woman Sarah Austin. She's a YouTuber. Our old friend David Fitzgerald comes back.
Oh, wow.
That'll be fun, too. Yeah. And Anthony Magdabasco gives us another lesson in street epistemology.
Yay.
In June, we'll have Dr. Ben Davis, our favorite nuclear physicist, comes back to tell us the difference between physics and quantum physics. And we'll also have our friend Andrew Jasko and Red Burks of the Skeptical Texans.
Oh,
we'll be talking about cults.
Oh, great.
And last but not least, we'll also have Hertzy Hertz from the Minnesota Atheist. I'll be on the show as well, and that's going to be in June. We got lots coming down the pipe.
I guess I'll show up.
Yeah, you better. I'm not doing all this by myself. My God.
Yeah. Christina's going to be excited for the cults.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm sure she'll have lots to say about that.
Oh, yes.
So, perfect. Thank you so much, ladies.
Until thank next
you. Time. Thank you. Not believe an infidel, a heathen. I call it how I see it. I say it's ignorance, and you just call it faith and unsubstantiated claims. That's something to be ashamed. I'm an atheist. I'm an atheist. I'm an atheist. I'm an atheist. Now let me take a. Don't mean to sound so hateful, but I swear to God, pun intended, I find it disgraceful that thousands of children are raped by priests, and since they're holy men of God, they get away scot-free.
keep it on the hush. Don't wanna affect business, he loves money too much. We know that they love the kids, but how the fuck can we protect them while they planning to molest them? We teaching them to respect them.
Respect them? Fuck that.
The system is broke down, working backwards, and the only action or tactic I plan to practice now is to attack them. The parties of God's hands are bloodstained, millions of murders by believers, and they're all in God's name. And let me take a sec, don't mean to sound so hateful, but I swear to God, pun intended, I find it disgraceful that many atheists are told to be quiet. You're not alone, speak your mind, time to let it be known. I'm proud to be an atheist, a skeptic, a non-believer, an infidel, a heathen, I call it how I see it. I say it's ignorance and you just call it faith, and unsubstantiated claims, that's something to be ashamed.